mind, what do you think of when you think or you hear public health? So you might think of reportable diseases. What else pops into people's mind when they're thinking about public health? What other examples, public health activities, can you think of? Okay, so certain health problems in a community. Okay, so understanding prevalence of disease or certain conditions within a population. Okay. What else pops into your mind when you think of public health?
Understanding the sort of determinants of health. So what goes into providing health care to an individual, both within a sort of institutional setting and within their own communities. So, access to food, nutrition, sort of local amenities, and then health resources.
Okay, so determinants of health, why is your population healthy or not healthy, understanding what those issues are and intervening. What else can people think of when they...
Say if there's an epidemic, viral infection or something, like how does a healthcare system going to react to it in terms of how to protect our people?
Okay. So response to epidemics. Okay, vaccination programs is something else that public health is involved in.
Educational programs.
Sure. If you had to summarize what underlies all of these activities, how would you define public health if you were trying to describe it to someone?
How does it differ from primary care?
Well, public health deals with looking after how healthcare is provided to large groups of people, to provinces, countries, international regions. It's sort of a broader picture of healthcare.
So one of the main defining elements of public health is that it's population-based specialties. So unlike a lot of other medical specialties where we're dealing with individuals, the focus in public health is a population. So it's a population-based approach rather than an individual-based approach. So when we're talking about disease prevention, promotion of healthy lifestyles, surveillance, health protection, it's ultimately targeted at individuals, but its focus is at the population level. So maybe we can flip...
Categories. So these are considered to be the main categories of what public health does. And you sort of get the idea from what you're telling us.
So we mentioned some of them. So for surveillance... that's knowing what's going on in a population. So we mentioned earlier to know what the prevalence of certain diseases, that's often done through certain disease registries, health surveys, communicable disease reporting. That all follows under the surveillance role of public health. You also have health promotion. So there you're talking about working with other governmental agencies and groups to ensure that there's healthy public policy. Healthy environments. Could you think of any examples, maybe in terms of health policies that public health might work on? Or?
Work safety.
Okay, so work safety policy, sure. I mean, smoking bans and laws related to smoking also would fall under promotion of sort of a healthier, healthy environment, healthier public policy. Public health work also falls under the category of prevention. So we mentioned immunization as one good example of prevention, but it also deals with healthy behaviors. So smoking, physical activity, diet, sexual health, although there's obviously some overlap with family practice and other medical interventions. Health prevention or prevention activities in public health, the focus is more at the population at large. Cancer detection might be another example of prevention activities. And then the final category that we covered a bit with dealing with outbreaks is health protection. So ensuring that water and air quality is safe, that there's food safety mechanisms in place, that there's a capacity to respond to outbreaks and also to respond to natural disasters as well. So that's usually what public health is responsible for. Do you know how public health is organized? What structure there is in Quebec or Ontario or wherever you might be working or living? How is public health organized in the province of Quebec? Who works for public health?
Dr. Carla and is in charge of public health
in Quebec. Yeah.
So actually, we're all involved to some degree. We're involved in disease reporting. We're seeing patients, involved in prevention activities. So in a way, the health system is working with public health, but...
The Minister of Health. Okay, so you can think of Quebec, right? Minister of Health is a politician. Not a bad thing, I suppose. Someone has to be a politician. So, Minister of Health's a politician, so he's going to have advisors. So you're setting up a public health network for Quebec. What would you want to do? Assuring the health of Quebec's population, how would you want to do it?
Regions.
Okay.
So there's 18 health regions in Quebec. So each health region is responsible for delivering clinical care to the population within its region. But they are also responsible for public health programs, so covering the issues that we just mentioned. And within each public health region, there's a public health director who's responsible, from a medical legal point of view, for the issues that we just mentioned. There's also a public health director for the province who's responsible at a provincial level, and there's a medical officer of health at the national level who's responsible for these issues throughout the country. So depending on where you're working, you may have a public health department in each health administration zone, but depending on how the health system is organized, it might be organized around a municipal basis. There might only be a public health structure at a state or a provincial level. So it may vary depending on which jurisdiction you're working in.
Ontario, what happens there? No idea. One of the best ways to figure out what your public health network is asking yourself who vaccinates the kids. Okay. So in Quebec, who vaccinates the kids? Nurses. Right. And where do those nurses live? Pardon? They live in CLSCs. Okay, so what Dr. Carlin is talking about is a division into major health centers, like Montreal is a health center, Region 6?
Yes.
So, and then we have subdivisions in Quebec into community health districts like CLSCs. So everyone in Quebec lives in a CLSC territory, and mandated public health programs are administered usually through these CLSCs, you know, the ones that are local. So the CLSC is responsible for making sure that all children in our territory are vaccinated. And we also have other mandates, mental health, social work. You know, there's other things that come along with the CLSC mandate. But a public health thing that involves reaching the population would go out through the CLSCs. And as Dr. Carlin was saying, it's different in different jurisdictions. So some places might be municipal regions of health. I think in Ontario it's municipal, isn't it, or county-wide?
Right.
Yeah. It's probably in Ottawa Board of Public Health, which would do the same type of thing. Okay. Now, not to say that physicians aren't vaccinating children and and nurses in other settings aren't vaccinating children, but the responsibility for making sure our children are vaccinated is a public health responsibility, and it's looked after by the public health network.
In your time during this clinical rotation, have you seen any other programs delivered within CLSCs that you spent time in? So vaccinations are a good example where they're primarily delivered in the CLSCs with the nursing professionals. But as Dr. Dalton was mentioning, there are also, particularly for Montreal, there's still a lot of vaccination activities that take place in family physician offices and other offices. What other, have you seen any other programs delivered by CLSCs that might be public health programs?
I know the dietitian the dietitians at the CLSC. I'm not sure to what extent, you know, public health programs in terms of nutrition and you know, counseling for specific patients at risk sort of trickles down to the CLSCs.
There are some health promotion activities within CLSCs related to nutrition and physical activity. That might be a bit variable from CLSC to CLSC, which services are offered. In terms of health promotion activities, smoking cessation. I think most CLSCs have centre d'abandon du tabac or smoking cessation counseling service that's available through most of them. There's also screening programs for sexually transmitted infections that are offered by a lot of CLSCs within Montreal and elsewhere.
And some things, as you're pointing out, are not CLSC defined. They're province wide. You know, can you think of a province wide screening program?
Breast cancer.
Okay. So what do you know about the breast cancer screening program? Letter in the mail. When do you get the letter in the mail? 50. When you turn 50, if you're a woman, you get a letter in the mail saying, it's time for your mammogram. Please report to one of these centers. You know, and if you do, then you're into the system, and you get that same letter every 2 years. Okay, and this is until you're 69 years of age. So between the age of 50 and 69, Quebec-wide, there's a screening program for breast cancer. And that would obviously have to be looked after by public health. Right? That's a mandate that goes beyond the doctor in his office. You know, it goes beyond even the CLSC. It's a provincial-wide public health matter. Now, we handed out these things.
Right, so I think that covers most of the basic functions of public health, but we also gave you a short, well, it's a chapter from a report written at the shortly after the SARS outbreak occurred, and it gives a history of the origin of public health from Greek times onwards. But it's a nice overview of the essential roles and functions of public health. So what we have up on the board is contained in Table 1, where it talks about the essential functions and some examples of what work public health may be doing. And it also talks a bit about the organization of public health services in Canada and some of the challenges in terms of the organization in a country such as Canada. So if you have a chance, there's some interesting historical tidbits. I don't think they mention Dr. Semmelweis in their historical summary of public health, but has anyone ever heard of Dr. Semmelweis, a man who's a bit
in your history of medicine course?
No, that's somebody else. That's Dr. Semmelweis had noted, he worked in Vienna, and he had noticed that in his hospital, where there were obstetricians doing deliveries and midwives doing deliveries, that the rates of infection were very different with the obstetricians versus the midwives. He also noticed that the obstetricians were doing autopsies and then doing deliveries, and he postulated that there was some link there. So for a period of time, he convinced the obstetricians to wash their hands, I believe, in chlorinated water. And there was a significant drop-off in terms of the number of infections. So what do you think happened in the hospital after that, once he shared his finding? So it was a version of sterile technique. Do you think they continued on with that? A loaded question. So in fact, for a period of time, I think it was before germ theory was clearly established. So it didn't make scientific sense to the obstetricians of the time. So they, despite the empiric evidence, went back to their usual habits. So it wasn't until much later that sort of that public health intervention was adopted. But that's just one example of some simple interventions and some of the history behind public health. But they also talk about cholera control and the water pump and some other interests.
The pump, we all know from the epidemic in London. And then again, that was before germ theory, right? People didn't know why people were getting cholera that drank from a certain well in a certain area of London, but they closed the well, you know, I mean, it was the logical thing to do. So, you know, we should be so logical. But anyways, so this gives a little bit of history of public health and a bit of its organization also here, I think, too, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, unless there's any, are there any questions about the general organization of public health before we move on to our next topic?
Good. Don't give them too much time for questions. So we wanted to talk about some specific programs related to public health because it isn't covered elsewhere. And someone mentioned safety, workplace safety. You know? The CSST, the Commission de Santé Sécurité au Travail, is a program in a way of public health. Okay. So what you know about the, in Ontario, it's called the Workmen's Compensation Board. What you know about CSST? It's province-wide, covers people that are working. What kind of coverage would it give them?
Well, in terms of workplace accidents, follow-up from that, so including long-term disability and compensation for that as well.
Mm-hmm. That's good. So it's an insurance scheme to cover for people when they've been injured on the work. Okay, but just we'll get to that because that's the important point, I think. But in terms of public health, all of these things. Okay, so how would CSST be involved in surveillance?
It sends auditors who basically assess the institutions to see if they meet certain standards.
Mm-hmm. And they also receive reports from all of us whenever we see a work-related accident, right? So they're getting these reports, they're compiling them, and they're seeing if there's problems with that. So there's surveillance involved. Health promotion?
There are actually recent ad campaigns on TV that go over workplace safety and some of the common things.
Sure. There are province-wide things. There are also specific things for specific industries. For example, in the construction industry, you'll see, hard hat obligatory, work boots obligatory when you're on this site sort of thing. And they'll have people going around to make sure that's happening. So that's a way of, prevention, okay, but also promotion if you're teaching people to prevent injury, it counts as well. And protecting the population is something that happens along with this, right? So if, for example, they're finding a certain factory has a large number of accidents in it, they'll be seeing if they can protect other people from having the same type of injury, okay? Or if it's something that could go into every single factory that does this same thing, Now, just on a practical nature, we wanted to go through with you the CSST forms. Have any of you had any work-related accidents with patients that you've had to treat so far? No. Yes? No. Okay. Well, there's a sheet. Here, we'll hand this around. 1, 2, 3 that way. You that way. And these relate to these forms here. I have to them separately. I'll get three this way. Okay. So some over here. Some of these. Now, forms are boring, but they help illustrate the point, I think. These are the forms you have to fill out whenever you see a worker who's been injured. Okay? So the first one we're talking is the green one. And I've given you a little handout that sort of has photocopies of them, but not in color. So the first report is the green one. And if you look at the green one, it will ask, obviously, the patient's identification, things like that. And it'll ask you if it's going to be 14 days or less, when the person's going to be better, basically, or when the lesion is going to be consolidated, is the way they talk about it. So if you have, for example, a cut to your hand when you've been slicing meat at the butcher shop, it's going to be better in a week. So you put down the date when they're going to be better, when the stitches are out, when things are going to be back to normal. Okay, sign it, give it to the worker. It counts as an off-work note as well. Now, if it's more than 14 days, you have to fill out this form and also the brown form. So why do you think 14 days? Pardon? In a way, you know, it's kind of an arbitrary number. We always think of pay periods as being 14 days. It's really kind of arbitrary. But it set up the CSST so that for the first 14 days, the employer has to pay the person who's been injured. Okay, the insurance plan doesn't kick in. They still get the reports, but they're not. The CSST is actually not paying the worker. It's the employer who does, and they're mandated to do so for the first 14 days. After that, it's the CSST that kicks in. Okay, so that's where they're going to need the Brown form. So if you have someone who's working in a factory and, you know, things are going along like this, and he's pulling this lever and it's going ka-chunk, 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 and he goes ka-chunk and chops off his left arm, you know, he's had an injury that's probably going to last more than 14 days, you know. So you'll be filling out the green form and also the Brown form. You don't have to put down when it's going to be better when you're using the Brown form. You just say whether it's going to be more or less than 60 days, in this case, more than 60 days. And you're going to write down if he's been referred to other things. In this case, he'd be referred to a surgeon. He'd probably be end up referred to, you know, physical therapy, occupational therapy, a number of other things. So every single time that worker sees any doctor for any reason related to that accident, he has to walk away with one of these Brown forms, okay?
I just have a question. Mm-hmm. This is in terms of return to work, like if they can return to work in 14 days. It's not in terms of how long the disability lasts.
Well, that's why they use the word consolidation.
Okay.
This guy's arm is not going to grow back.
Right.
Okay. So we can't talk about it being healed. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point of time, it's going to be repaired surgically. He's going to have a prosthetic arm. We're not going to be doing anything more for this person, so it is consolidated.
Right. Okay.
At that point, you're filling out the last form, which is the blue one, which says it's all over. That's the rapport final. And in that, you're indicating if there's been any permanent sequela to what's gone on. So in this case, yes, the guy's lost his arm, you know. So there's permanent disability involved with that. And there's a compensation that happens to that person based on how much of a disability he or she has received as a result of the accident. Most, the CSST will try to reintegrate people into the workplace, you know, one way or another in their own job or a similar job, or they will try to re-educate them to do other kind of work because they really don't want them on insurance forever, you know, they'd like to see them, you know, back in the workforce. So they will do a lot to try to facilitate this to get them back into the regular type of workplace, okay? Now, this is, are there questions about that, first of all? Yeah. Good for you. But she anticipates my next subject. Yes.
So we will
just go home. Yeah.
So we'll cover that in a bit more detail, I guess.
Yeah, but that's a very good point. Yeah. Now, a retraite préventive, let's move to that. Why not?
Sure.
Yeah. What is that? What are we talking about here? Is it a worker who's sick? No. Is it a worker who's injured? No. Okay, it's a worker who is pregnant, okay? So there are certain situations where your regular job is fine, but it's not fine if you're pregnant. Right? What might those situations be?
Okay.
Maybe. Depends what you do, you know? Daycare, x-rays, radiology. Now remember, no one should be in a situation where they're at risk, right? And if you're doing something that's dangerous anyways, it doesn't matter whether you're pregnant, you shouldn't be doing it. So, you know, there's supposed to be some control on radiation in radiology settings, but still, it's one of the things you'd consider. You mentioned daycare settings. What's the concern with education of young children or dealing with young children? What's the worry?
Mm-hmm.
Rubella, you should have your vaccine.
Fifth disease.
Parvovirus B19 is the biggie, right, because it has been shown to be associated with fetal death. So if you're dealing with children in that age group, you are immediately put on preventative leave, okay? So that's one of the programs of the CSST. Now, if you can demonstrate that the person already has antibodies to parvovirus B19, there's no particular reason why they can't go back to that workplace. Or they could be reassigned to something else that's outside the danger area. Okay, so it's also a possibility is work reassignment. So these are things that CSST would try to work with you. But Retraite Préventive is one of the big programs of the CSST for women who are pregnant. They usually don't go against the doctor's advice. So, you know, if the doctor's advising that the woman be off for one reason or another, they'll usually let that go.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Quebec program. Mm-hmm.
So
I imagine.
And it's a program that's set up. It's a decision between the woman and her treating physician, and then the CSST usually provides general guidelines or clear advice in terms of whether it's indicated to be in that work setting or not. But if it's ultimately a decision with the treating physician and the patient.
But it's a one-way thing, as in it's like you're protecting that patient. It's not you're protecting the public from that patient. Like, let's say it's the patient with H1N1 that is told to kind of stay at home. That's not the same thing.
It's also public health, but it's not préventive. That's another issue. Quarantine is another issue. But it's not.
The program is set up to protect pregnant women and the developing fetus for a healthy pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's looking at issues like Dr. Dalton was mentioning in terms of infections that they might be exposed to, environmental toxins where if they weren't pregnant it might not pose as much of a risk, but the fetus might be particularly susceptible to those exposures.
Latter part of pregnancy standing a lot. You know, we look at cashiers, coiffeuses, people that are on their feet a lot, it becomes very difficult at the end of pregnancy, you know, low back pain, and just generally difficult. You know, so these are things also where it would be considered.
So it's only like to certain gestational weeks, it's not since the beginning of pregnancy,
Through the pregnancy. Some things relate to different times of pregnancy, like standing. Is not a problem for the first two trimesters, right? But in the third, it can be a bit cumbersome, you know, a little bit difficult. So that's when it starts to become an issue. Yeah, we went through this recently with the H1N1, you know, with medical professionals. You know, if you're pregnant and you're likely to be exposed to H1N1, you know, H1N1 had a disproportionately high risk of mortality in pregnant women. So, you know, we had to withdraw, for example, our residents who were pregnant from any situation where they might be at risk. You know, some did not want to do that. They wanted to continue their residency, and that was respected, but at least the option is there if you wanted to be withdrawn. Mm-hmm. Now, one other thing to look at the CSST, the brown one, if you have the brown one around, at the very bottom on the left, you say, cachez s'il y a lieu. Do you see that at the very bottom? If you're a victim of a criminal act, or if you're injured while you're helping someone in an act of civic responsibility, these are two special programs of the CSST where you do not have to be a worker. You do not have to be employed. Okay? So if you're a victim of a criminal act in Quebec, it's the same forms. You fill out one of these if you're seeing the person, and say you've been robbed, for example, and hit over the head or something, it would fall under this. This is Indemnisation pour les victimes d'actes criminels, which is the IVAC you hear about. IVAC, which is the program of the government to for help with this. Here at CLSC Metro, we're the sexual assault center, so we'll often fill these out for victims of sexual assault in case the victim might need later psychological counseling. You know, if we're talking about potential post-traumatic stress disorder or something of that sort, you know, it's not, psychological services are not covered readily in our system, so it'd be a way of financing that if necessary. Okay. Now, I actually haven't seen anyone who's ever been injured in the line of trying to rescue other people, but I suppose it could happen, and that would fall under the same program. Have you?
No, not yet.
Mm-hmm.
But just to underline, though, that it doesn't have to be at all related to the work environment. So although the CSST is administering the program, it really is no matter where you're a victim of a criminal act or where you decide to be heroic and save someone, it will be covered, and it's covered by this program outside of the work environment.
Mm. It doesn't count if you're trying to save one of your fellow students from boredom during a public health lecture. Okay, it has to be a really serious situation, all right? Now, as we're talking about here, you know, the CSST gets all these reports or a copy of them, right? The person comes back to the to his boss and gives a sheet of paper. The boss takes one sheet for the chart, gives one sheet to the CSST. So if the CSST starts seeing, well, wait a second, this is the sixth guy this month who's lost his left arm at this factory on this machine, you know, they'll be visiting, you know, and they'll be checking things out. It doesn't have to be that drastic either. There are regular inspections. But also, you know, the companies can be fined if they're in violation of CSST on a regular basis. So it's in the interest of the employer, not just because he cares about his employees, but because he will be fined. So it's important for them to try to reduce injuries in the workplace, and it's part of the surveillance activities of the CSST. Anything else about CSST? I thought not. Questions? None? Good. You can ask a question if you like. We can make up an answer. No? Hmm? Nothing? Good, 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 good.
Next topic?
Why not?
All right. So we've covered general areas of public health, workers' health, CSST. Our next topic is to do with notifiable conditions. What do you know about notifiable conditions? Or in Quebec, the term that's often used is maladie à déclaration obligatoire, or MADOS is the abbreviation, so often people use that term. What is a MADO? Or what are some examples of MADOs?
What's that?
So chlamydia was one example. Tuberculosis is an example.
Okay, going to get a pen that works. How about this one? Okay, TB.
So what's unique about tuberculosis as a notifiable condition?
Well, I mean, in what way? I mean, it's a disease that that's beginning to show multi-drug resistance and is especially prevalent.
Okay. So we're obliged or we're required to report any of these declarable conditions.
Right.
In the case of tuberculosis, there's also an obligation to treat an individual.
Okay.
So there's really, there's also maladie à traitement obligatoire, which is which means that someone cannot refuse treatment with active TB where they're at risk of transmitting the infection to others. So we all know that a large proportion of the planet is infected with tuberculosis. It's not those individuals that are forced to receive treatment, but if somebody refused treatment and had active pulmonary TB, then they'd be obliged to receive treatment. It used to include syphilis as under the older public health law, but that was removed. So now it's just tuberculosis.
They should also probably get an obligatory psychiatric exam if they're refusing treatment for active tuberculosis. But that's, yeah.
So we've given a couple of examples of sexually transmitted infections that are maladie à déclaration obligatoire. So there's chlamydia, syphilis. What other sexually transmitted infections? Gonorrhea. Is HIV a declarable infection? Yes, no, sometimes. So HIV is a special case in that it's declarable if somebody has given or received blood, tissues, or organs. Maybe this would be a good point to look at, or time to look at, when we declare an infection, who are you declaring it to, or how do you declare an infection or condition?
Family physician who sees a patient basically sends it to the department that looks after the surveillance of these communicable diseases.
So who is this department that you're referring to in Quebec?
I'm not sure what the...
So it's the regional public health department that you're declaring the infection to. You're not sending the information to the province. You're not sending it to the Public Health Agency of Canada. It's to the regional public health department. So in the case of Montreal, there's the regional public health department that receives that information. And what information are you giving on the individual with, let's say, Sally Smith has chlamydia.
Oh, silly.
So, what information are you providing the public health department?
I think, don't you just give, isn't it just the information that there is a patient who has this STI, but you don't provide the name, you don't provide the...
No, it actually, it used to be, under an older public health law, there were some declarable conditions where the name wasn't provided. But for declarable conditions, you're providing to the regional public health department the person's name, their date of birth, their RAMQ number, their address and telephone number, the disease that you're declaring to public health, so in the case of chlamydia. For certain infections, you have to provide information on blood, tissue, organ exposures or donations. So that's more relevant to certain blood-borne infections. So HIV is an example of that, where that information is provided, as is, Dr. Dalton's writing down, hepatitis B and C. You're also providing information about the person's occupation. Can you think of why that might be relevant in a declaration?
Sex trade
worker. So for sexually transmitted infections, it might be relevant if they're a sex trade worker. But if once we get to some other declarations, what other?
I mean, if they're like a healthcare professional, or they're dealing in a in a way with, if they have an occupation where they're in direct communication with people, their body fluids, or there's an occupation where there is that capacity for that transmission.
So there might be an occupational risk in terms of exposure that would be interesting to public health, or there could be a risk of transmitting to other people. So I think one example might be, we wrote down hepatitis A, which can be foodborne. If somebody was a food handler and working in a restaurant or a kitchen or a factory where they might expose other people to hepatitis A, that would be particularly relevant. It is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the examples that we often use is there was a Shigella outbreak in a restaurant in our territory here, and so public health identified it, went into the restaurant, insisted that all the workers in the restaurant go to this CLSC to have rectal swabs. Okay, which of course we had the medical student do. And that's a way of public health responding to the issue of a Shigella outbreak. Okay, so that's one example of why it's important to know their occupation. They're working in restaurants, and one of them's carrying Shigella.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how? Shigella. So that's the information you're providing to public health.
Oh, we're missing a lot of stuff.
How can you inform public health about it? So you can call them. So depending on the urgency of the situation, for all public health departments in Quebec have somebody on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, to respond for more urgent situations. So if you had a meningococcal case and the child was attending daycare, or a measles case, the child was in daycare, a situation where you thought that maybe public health might need to intervene quite quickly, those would be cases that you could call someone about. There might be other situations where there's not the same urgency to inform public health, where you could either, you can fax the information. There's usually standard reporting forms that are available. You can mail that information in. Are you required to give that information? I mean, if Sally turns to you and says, "My mother works for public health," I'll be like kicked out of the house if you send in the report.
I don't know, there's an O at the end. I'm going to say it's obligatory.
So it is obligatory. It goes against, for most things within the doctor-patient relationship are confidential, and it's not divulged to a third party without the patient's permission. But this is one case where it's in the Code of Ethics of Physicians and also within the public health law that we're required to declare these conditions to public health. There may be situations where you might call public health directly if you were concerned about the patient being contacted about this information by a third party, that it could cause some problems. It's usually a good idea to have a discussion with the patient as well. I had one patient myself who had chronic hepatitis B as a refugee and was received, I think, a letter or something from public health, didn't really understand the purpose behind it, and was very, very, very upset that, you know, that was automatically communicated to her hearing committee and all public agencies. So you can explain to the patient what it means to declare an infection. It is kept confidential, so the only people with access to that nominal information are people who may do an intervention, a public health intervention related to the case.
In terms of the infections, how do they contact, let's say, the partners or past partners of people diagnosed?
So that depends on where you're working and what services your public health department offers. So there may be areas where the public health department would go and do systematic contact tracing for all sexually transmitted infections without the assistance of the physician or without informing them. Or they may contact the physician and ask, have you done contact tracing? Do you need any assistance? We'll carry that out. In the case of, let's use chlamydia as an example, you're the clinician taking care of Sally. Sorry to pick on Sally. But what would you offer her in terms of treatment and follow-up related to her chlamydia infection?
As in, like, antibiotic treatment?
Mm-hmm. So how would you treat her, first of all, for her chlamydia? So if you wanted to treat chlamydia and gonorrhea, you could give cefixime and azithromycin. For chlamydia alone, the usual treatment is azithromycin, 1 gram, PO times one dose. And on the prescription in Quebec, you can write code K, and that is a public health program. So with that code, she can go get free medication to treat her illness. And in the case of her contacts, you can write on their prescriptions code L, and they can also get a free prescription. I remember K for case and L for lover, but that's not why those initials are there. So how would we do that contact follow-up, or who should we be contacting in terms of her sexual partners? We know Sally has chlamydia. Who's considered a contact in this case?
Her mother? Probably not.
Okay, so sexual first of all, partners, sexual right. contact. Yeah. So the process is very similar for other declarable infections. In the case of chlamydia, it's sexually transmitted, so you're only looking at sexual partners. Usually, you look at the sexual partners that she's had in the past 60 days, or if she hasn't been sexually active in that time, her last sexual partner. So you can do what's called a negotiated approach with the patient, where you see, well, how are we going to go about contacting your partners? Are you able to contact these individuals? Some people may not have contact information, and there's nothing that we can do with that. The patient may prefer to contact them directly, their partners, in which case it's generally recommended to do some sort of follow-up with the patient to make sure that everything went okay with that. You can offer to call the partners yourself. And if that's not possible, or if it, in some cases it might be outside of the city you're working in or in another province, you can also call your public health department and see what sort of help they can provide you in that case.
But it's confidential, like, where you're getting the information from?
Yes. It's tricky, right? I mean, you can write on these declaration forms, please don't call this patient, call me first, you know, in case they are going to phone. They'll phone you first. You can discuss it with the person at public health if you want to do that. The public health people are pretty good at, you know, phoning the person up, identifying who the contacts might be, need help with that, and calling those people and saying, it has been reported to us that you may have been exposed to X, Y, or Z. Please go see your doctor. And they don't say who it was. And apparently often people are mistaken when they try to figure out who it was that reported this. But, you know, so, you know, it's... obviously, there's a limit to how confidential it can be, right? If you've had one sexual partner and you're suddenly getting a call from a public health nurse who's saying, someone has said, you know, it, you know, but that's not
the
usual case.
But it's true. You're not, with part of the contact tracing, you're not saying to the individual, so-and-so has identified you as a sexual contact. It's done in a confidential manner. In terms of giving a prescription, that's not an ideal practice, but my understanding is that you'd be best off to write if on the prescription azithromycin 1 gram, if no contraindications, because you're not really in a situation either to evaluate the patient or check for allergies. For women, for instance, they may have been exposed to chlamydia, but they may have also developed pelvic inflammatory disease in the meantime. So they would be better off with a clinical evaluation as part of that contact tracing.
I personally feel it's really not good to treat people whom you haven't seen. I mean, and we do it occasionally when there's simply no other choice, but you really want to avoid that at all costs if you can. What I'll often do is I'll give a note to the patient, my patient, saying, you know, have your partner take this note to his doctor, okay? And the note will say the partner of this patient, the person presenting with the note, has been treated for chlamydia, okay? Because, you know, it's clear then. If not, if he just phones, say, his girlfriend and says, you know, I might have something, you should see your doctor, and she goes to see the doctor and has, a pap test, and doesn't have a gonorrhea or chlamydia test, she will go away with no treatment and perhaps with the impression that everything is just fine, you know? So it's important that they arrive with clear indications of why they're seeing the doctor and what they need treatment for. If it's not going to be you, the ideal is probably to have them come back and see you.
And in the case of sexually transmitted infections, just to finish off with that category of declarable conditions, public health may contact a patient for contact tracing, but they may also contact a patient to get some epidemiological information. For instance, they might want to know, well, who is this person having sex with? Are they men or women? Where are they having sex? Is it in a sauna? Are they meeting people in a bar? Are they meeting them on the internet? And the reason they look for that information is then they can target some prevention or promotional activities within a certain milieu. So if you found that there was a syphilis outbreak in your city related to sexual exposures in saunas or sexual exposures from picking up people on the internet, you could try and target your prevention activities in those areas as a way of controlling the spread as well.
What is the HIV in practice? You mentioned that was a
difference. So, in Quebec, and I wish I could tell you for Ontario, I don't know, in Quebec, you only declare HIV to your regional public health department in the situation where there's a blood, tissue, or organ exposure or donation. That's not to say that there isn't any intervention either with the patient when they're seeing their clinician to do some contact tracing, but it goes back a very long time in the case of HIV, so it's not practical as a way of stopping the spread. But there's also a surveillance program in place. So for Quebec, every single HIV test is confirmed at the provincial lab. So when they do a test that's positive at the provincial lab, they have a system that verifies if that person's ever been tested before, tested positive. And if they haven't, then it's the provincial lab that goes back and contacts the ordering clinician, gets some basic information so that there's an idea about who the person is and age profile, gender, etc., exposures. And that's the surveillance system in place for HIV. Can you think of a reason? Up until 2002, we used to follow it by looking at AIDS declarations at the regional public health department. And why do you think that was changed around the law was modified in, I think, 2002 or 2003? What happened with AIDS cases at the end of the 90s? So there was treatment, so with highly active antiretroviral therapy. So all of a sudden there was a drop-off in terms of the numbers of AIDS cases. So what does that mean in terms of the number of new HIV infections in the population? Are there more infections? Are there less infections? Are there the same number of infections?
So if you look at HIV cases, still rising. So there's no point in following AIDS, you know, basically.
So actually the system was changed to have a better idea about what was going on with the epidemic because the surveillance system in place, you weren't sure if there were increasing numbers or decreasing numbers in terms of infection. And by using the provincial lab surveillance, you can see the number of new infections per year.
They're getting way ahead of us, you know. They're getting ahead of us. Because I'm giving handouts based on their questions, and they're ahead of us.
I know. That's they should know all the answers
well,
then
you know,
for
I wonder,
the camera.
The two handouts. One is, the first one is an overview of the declarable illnesses. That's the one with the staple. That gives you an idea of our obligation to treat and gives some examples. The other one we handed out was in response to the question about when you notify partners. And it's a table of the time period for notifying partners. For example, chlamydia you see is 60 days, gonorrhea as well. Other things could be longer or shorter. Okay, so it gives you some idea of your obligation to declare. And while we're handing out pieces of paper in our deforestation project, this is the actual form you use to declare any of these illnesses. Medical students, for some reason, always think of the sexually transmitted diseases first. But as you can see from what Dr. Carlin wrote, you know, there's large categories of diseases that are reportable illnesses. And, you know, one of the main ones is vaccine-preventable illnesses. So, you know, if we're starting to see an uprise in measles, then, you know, it's...
Or any measles at all in the case
of Quebec. Any measles.
Yeah. For the list of declarable conditions, it is, like Dr. Dalton mentioned, not limited to sexually transmitted infections, although they account for a large percentage of declarable conditions presently. On the back of the form, which is the reporting form for Montreal, which covers most of the information we talked about earlier, there's a list of declarable conditions. As you can see, it's quite long. It's not the same from province to province. There are some conditions under national surveillance, which are similar between all provinces, but there may be some variation from province to province, what is a notifiable condition from country to country. So it's important when you're working to be aware of what needs to be notified. But they do fall into some general large categories. So vaccine-preventable illness covers a lot of infections or diseases on this list. So measles, mumps, rubella, meningococcal infections, invasive streptococcal pneumonia infections. There are some vaccine-preventable illnesses that aren't on the list, like varicella, but they're more of an exception. So if you see somebody with something that you have a vaccine to prevent, it might be on the list. We covered sexually transmitted illnesses, but not all sexually transmitted illnesses are on the list either. So herpes, genital warts, those are two sexually transmitted conditions that aren't notifiable. One other large category is food and waterborne illness. So the salmonellas, shigellas, yersinias, listeria, to think of something that was in the news recently, things that may be transmitted by food or water. Even if you don't have a specific cause, if you're working in your emergency room or anywhere and you notice that you're seeing suddenly all these people that attended one particular event and you think they might have had a common exposure and you're not sure what the virus or bacteria or toxin might be that caused it, you can still declare those to your public health department as well. Mm-hmm. Another large category are zoonotic diseases, so diseases that can spread from animals to humans. So West Nile virus is an example that was in the news a lot a few years ago. Lyme disease is another example of a zoonotic infection. It also covers things that aren't infections, so environmental exposures, so the effects of asbestos on the lungs, any of those conditions are also included. There's a list at the top where they say under extreme surveillance.
Those are the fun ones, the ones at the top.
So they're rare. So for instance, we've eradicated smallpox from the planet. So if you did see a case of smallpox, likely related to bioterrorism or some other event like that, you're required to declare that by phone, not by mail,
no, you shouldn't
as soon as possible.
You don't fill out the form and say, I saw someone with smallpox. No, yeah.
But there are some other examples, like botulism, where there's an intervention that's quite speedy, or hemorrhagic fever, so Ebola virus, if somebody's returning from overseas and is hemorrhaging.
From their eyes,
then,
and you
then
fall.
Then you're required to declare those. So there's some rare conditions in the list of some very severe illnesses.
Careful when you declare them, because the public health people will probably come to your office and lock you in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you'll notice as well on the list that not everything is declared by the physician. Some of these conditions are only declared by the lab. Mm-hmm. So where there's a P, it means the physician's obligated to declare. Where there's an L, it's the lab who declares. And in some cases, it's both. There are, under Quebec public health care law, you're also not limited to this list. So if you see something that you think is a threat to the population, you suddenly see a cluster of some unknown illness where your healthcare workers are in the ICU and you don't know what's going on with the respiratory illness. I mean, SARS wasn't on a declarable disease list before. That can be signaled to public health. And it's not limited to physicians. So for sexually transmitted infections, it's physicians who can report. But other healthcare personnel and even administrators under the Quebec public healthcare law can declare some of these other outbreaks or conditions. Any questions about MADOs?
Has anyone filled out a form yet?
Mm-hmm. They will.
Yeah, they will. Yeah, it's something that every, at least every family doctor has a copy of this form in the office. You know, and we do it regularly. The laboratories are often good too when they're giving a result with stamping the result and saying this is a declarable disease. You know, to remind you that you have to fill out your form, which is sometimes helpful as well.
Yeah. And it's like I say, there is the if you suspect a disease and you're not sure if you need to report it to public health or not, you can always contact them. Even if there's not an immediate intervention, if there's a risk that's there, so you're suspecting somebody has hepatitis A and they are a restaurant worker or work in a grocery store, it helps if public health is informed in advance so they can follow up on the case and sometimes even speed up the lab result to know what's going on in case there's an intervention.
I had a person who said, yeah, went to a restaurant and had thought might have hepatitis A. Tell them, you know, don't go to work.
I mean, as family doctors, we're supposed to know what our patients do and who their family is, what their work is. So somebody who has a gastroenteric illness who works in a restaurant, I think it's reasonable, even if you don't have a specific disease, at least to think about that aspect of the illness, that they have a job and that they might be putting others at risk if mm-hmm. they go back to work.
Sure. I mean, even if it's not hepatitis A, right, even if it's regular viral gastroenteritis, you'd want to probably keep a restaurant worker at home and tell them to wash their hands a whole lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's true. Yep. So Sally's been declared to public health.
I think we're okay then.
Good. Moving on to something else. What else?
We've usually talked about the coming influenza pandemic.
Yeah, we've stopped talking about the coming influenza pandemic because it came. Yeah.
But maybe we can still talk about it a little bit.
Sure.
Maybe what I'll do. Where are we?
Oh, don't ask me. No, those are old, I think.
Old ones?
I think old ones.
I want
ones are
the first one.
Oh, the first one. Oh, yeah, that'd be. Yeah.
There we are.
That's the first one. Okay. Yeah.
So maybe we can start by thinking what public health's role might be in an emergency situation like a pandemic. And we can go back to the basic functions or roles of public health. What would you do during an influenza pandemic if you were a public health department related to surveillance, health promotion, prevention, and health protection? What would you do for surveillance?
We want to have hospitals reporting all confirmed cases to sort of see, to be able to track surveillance infection.
Okay. So you want to have some surveillance system where you're picking up confirmed cases. Why would you want to have that type of surveillance in a pandemic?
What would be your goals?
Look at spread, to look at you know, estimation of numbers in terms of vaccine preparation, basically in order to prepare for also the resources to allocate.
So your surveillance could give you an idea about the numbers of people being affected and who is being affected. In the case of the H1N1 virus, who was affected by this particular infection? So younger people. So normally, if we look at flu outbreaks, the people who are hospitalized or have complications from the flu, they often have chronic medical conditions or they're the elderly. But if you look at the numbers from the H1N1 outbreak, a lot of the people who ended up in the hospital may have had an underlying health condition, but you didn't see as much evidence of elderly individuals being hospitalized. So you can look at the demographic, who's being affected, and target your interventions based on that. And you can also get an idea about the severity as well. So not all influenza viruses have the same severity. To give an example, there's avian influenza, the H5N1 virus that people were talking about before this all occurred. There, the mortality rate, the morbidity mortality associated with the virus is very high. So one of the first goals of the surveillance system was to get an idea, well, what sort of what problem are we dealing with? How many people are ending up in the hospital with this? As much as possible to get an idea how many people are being infected and how many people are dying from this infection and what sort of demographics do they have, what underlying health conditions. So you want a good surveillance system to know what's going on so that you can respond in a logical way. What about prevention?
Washing, educational, there are signs everywhere in the hospital. Not
coughing
on each other.
Okay, so we'll get to vaccine in a minute because that's a whole separate topic. But hand washing, both in healthcare and outside of healthcare, preventive measures, there's respiratory hygiene where people are encouraged to wear masks and wash their hands on arrival at healthcare institutions as a way of minimizing spread. Just out of interest, they did a study in New Zealand at a hospital, I think, experiencing an outbreak, and what percentage of people, despite clear indications to put on a mask and wash their hands, what percentage of people do you think followed that? This was at a hospital where they were having an outbreak. I wish I could remember the exact, but it was less than a third. It was a very low percentage of people with where that was clearly, there wasn't anybody who would then stop. Maybe there was afterwards, but...
Oops, excuse me.
But there may be recommendations that are made by public health, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the population or even the healthcare environment will respond the way you expect, or to 100% of the population is going to be compliant with your recommendations. What about quarantine? Was that used very much for influenza H1N1?
More in your own home kind of thing. It's more like don't come to work if you have H1N1, you stay home. But not
okay.
Like
what is quarantine?
Just isolate somebody who's actually has an infection.
Okay, is there a difference between isolation and quarantine? Basic
and like enforced by.
Well, when we talk about isolation, so you'll see that when you work in a hospital, there may be people in isolation to prevent respiratory spread or contact spread. It depends on the infection that they have, what type of isolation measures are in place. Isolation is for somebody who is ill, and we usually reserve quarantine for people who are not ill but at risk of developing the infection. So in the case of influenza, it was mainly isolation that was encouraged. So if somebody was ill, you should stay home for about 7 days from the onset of illness. And although it didn't completely prevent the spread of the illness, it limited the spread by having fewer people with influenza at school, at work, in the hospitals. In the case of SARS, there was a combination of both isolation and quarantine. So once you had somebody with the illness, you'd look at, well, who were you in contact with, and had those people stay at home in the time that they normally would incubate or develop the illness, and if they then became sick, they were exposing fewer people. So that actually came from, I think, from Venice back in during the bubonic plague, where they kept ships, for 40 days, quarantine. Just to make sure that there was no illness on the vessel, and then afterwards they were allowed to come into the city. So that's where the term comes from. So, but definitely there were preventive measures that were aimed at limiting the spread of infection. And additional measures, so using N95 masks or where there was a risk of aerosolization of the virus where people might be exposed with like intubation or other aerosol-producing procedures, making sure healthcare workers had material to protect themselves, so having masks and gloves available.
Now, the H1N1 is what we're using as an example, but we've been waiting for the epidemic to come for some time, right? I mean, everyone knows that something's going to be coming. Now, again, you're in charge of public health for Quebec. How would you prepare for this? We've seen it in action because it just happened. But, for example, do you think Quebec had a stockpile of Tamiflu?
No.
Okay. Do you think they had a stockpile of masks? Not sure. Do you think we've designated places beforehand, long before this hit, where people would go if there were major outbreaks of illness where we could no longer deal with them in the hospital?
So, Dr. Carl. So you had a long list there. So what was the first thing? So, I mean, in terms of access to treatment, there was medication that was stockpiled, specifically antivirals, so primarily also Tamivir. Since it's not a very commonly used medication, it's mainly used for institutional outbreaks, that was stockpiled in case of increased demand in the event of a pandemic. And there were millions of doses stockpiled for Quebec in anticipation of the pandemic.
This is long before H1N1.
And all public health departments as well had available medication within their public health region. So even a small isolated region like my own had a small reserve of oseltamivir available in case of the pandemic occurring or initial cases that might be severe. There was material that was stockpiled, and in fact, after the first wave, some of that was looked at again because of experience in Australia where they had a lot of increased demands in the intensive care units. There they had a large demand for certain respiratory assist machines, I think extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, if I remember correctly.
ECMO
machines. So for in Canada, for a second wave in the fall or the winter, that was something that was looked at in anticipation of the pandemic. What else did you cover on your list? Oh, sites.
Sites, so. Non-traditional sites is what they're called. And yes, there are designated sites in, for example, Montreal, designated long before H1N1, where if there was a major pandemic and people were dropping like flies with a third of the population infected and deaths faster than we could accumulate them, we would not be sending sick people to the hospitals, right? That would be the last place you'd want to send them. There are non-traditional sites that were set up where we would send people with flu-like illness where they could be triaged, treated on site, and only refer to the hospital if they needed those ICU facilities. So there was even some talk about separate ICU facilities when things were getting really bad. The reason I bring it up is that, as Dr. Carlin was saying, the preparation for these things is done by the public health department long before they happen. Right? Now, you can't predict everything, right? But in this case, it might have seemed to the population that the public health department was responding to things as they came along. That wasn't the case. They were putting into action this level of care. Okay, things have gotten worse. We're now going to go to this level of care. But the plan was there all along, and had been laid out and prepared long in advance. Is that fair?
That's fair. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's also fair to put, we mentioned vaccination. That was one of the central elements of pandemic planning. How long does it usually take to produce an influenza vaccine?
Almost a year.
So usually, you're right, in terms of a year, the decision as to what we will be vaccinating for the next flu season, that's often made about a year in advance, but it takes a minimum of 6 months once you know what flu you're vaccinating against to get the initial doses of the vaccine to the population. So the outbreak of this new H1N1 strain started the end of April, and it took from that point to the end of October, that's when the initial doses of the influenza vaccine in Canada first became available. So up until that time, the only options we had were prevention, treating ill people. But unlike the Southern Hemisphere, we actually had the opportunity to start vaccinating the population during the second wave of the epidemic. So who did we vaccinate against influenza H1N1?
Pregnant mothers.
Okay, so we vaccinated initially. I mean, the vaccine, the goal was to offer it to the whole population, but initially it was offered to certain at-risk groups who might be at risk for complications. So that was young children, pregnant women, young people with chronic illness, also to vaccinate healthcare workers so that you had people to deliver the vaccine programs and work in the hospitals. But ultimately, the vaccine was open to the entire population. So are we still seeing influenza H1N1 activity in Canada at this point? Or what's the situation with the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, basically, we passed the peak. I mean, there were two waves or something like that.
Okay, so we've had two waves of the outbreak. The initial wave was very small in the summer. So usually we only see flu in the winter, and we had flu in the summer, and then we also had it in the fall, which is unusual. So we've had two waves, and actually the second wave officially ended in the middle of December based on the surveillance information that we talked about earlier. So although there may be cases of influenza H1N1, we're not having any large-scale outbreaks, and we've actually attained a fairly high vaccination coverage for the province as a whole. I forget the most recent number. For the province, it's over half of the population has been vaccinated. You have a significant percentage of the population who's been infected as well during the first two waves of the infection. So the public health department for the province doesn't think that it's likely that we'd have continued waves of this illness. You might see cases, but nothing in excess of a usual flu season or even less than a usual flu season at this point.
Another fun thing that happened at the beginning of the H1N1 is we all received, all doctors in Quebec, all doctors? All family physicians, I'm not sure, received something called an appel à la vigilance. And these are communiques that come from the public health department telling doctors to beware, you know. And we all take these very, very seriously when you suddenly get this thing that says appel à la vigilance, you know. So usually it's something like a case of measles has been reported in Châteauguay. Okay, well, okay. But if you see someone who's sick with a rash and you're not sure, think measles. I mean, we don't think about measles much, right? So these appel à la vigilance warn us that something's coming. The first one for H1N1 was an appel à la vigilance warning there is an unusual influenza-like illness happening in Mexico. We don't know the details, but be careful about anyone returning from Mexico. And that was a full week before this hit the news. So, you know, they're there and they're warning the doctors to be looking for these things. Yeah, so we take them very, very seriously. Yeah.
So that's influenza. Any questions about that?
Mm. You've all been through it now.
Yeah. I guess there was some, as the sort of, in between the first and second wave, I guess there was some confusion depending on the primary care providers and hospitals as to, you know, when is it still being reported, and like I guess some physicians thought it was still being reported, others, you know, weren't. I'm just wondering, like, you know, when, how often do those memos get sent in terms of, you know, to primary care providers when they should be reporting it or not?
Yeah, it's a very, I mean, that's a good point in mm-hmm. that there's a lot of information to transmit to a lot of different individuals in a very short period of time. So that's why there was so much planning that goes into an emergency like this. So the type of surveillance that you need at the start of the epidemic, where you don't have any information of the about the virus, is different than what you might need once you know that it's a usual type of influenza with not a particularly high mortality rate. So getting that information to primary care physicians, hospitals throughout the healthcare network is not always easy. And one of the elements in terms of emergency planning is to go back after the emergency and look at, well, what worked well this time, what needs to be improved, so that when we face a similar situation next time, it can be improved, just like what happened with SARS before, in terms of strengthening the public health system, and also strengthening, it wasn't just public health that responded here, it was also the emergency measures group or public safety who were involved in a lot of the interventions. I mean, more recently, not to go into a lot of detail, but I mean, we see Haiti on the news. That's another example where public health isn't primarily involved in terms of an intervention, but they might look at, well, what sort of public health issues are related to a natural disaster like that. So what do you think would be the main concerns in an earthquake or after an earthquake?
Okay.
So really a lot of issues related to, one, mass casualties, and also damage to your infrastructure. So ensuring that there's water safety, that there's access to water, and basic sanitation, food. What other issues might you think arise after? Do you think epidemics are always going to occur after after an earthquake? Is that? They can, but it's related more to sort of water safety issues and sanitation. So in the case of an earthquake, it's more casualties and need for medical care that the system has to respond to, and not necessarily epidemics in sort of the immediate after period of an earthquake. What about needs for medical personnel? People want to help, and everybody wants to jump on a plane, but is that necessarily helpful in all situations in an earthquake? Or?
Well, if you're putting them at risk, not necessarily. You have to make sure that it's a safe environment for people to go in, and in the end, they have to be organized in such a way that they're working together and not sort of against each other.
Right, so organization is a big aspect of it, and based on other emergency situations, most countries need help for, if they don't have certain personnel available, those might be the individuals that need to come to the country, but there's not necessarily an increased need immediately for nurses, doctors, just because there's been a disaster. A lot of the needs relate to just cleaning up the infrastructure and making sure people have access to clean water and have access to some basic medical care. Our last topic that we usually talk about is health determinants, which we may not have a blank sheet, but all right. What do you think makes a population healthy? What determines whether or not?
You're the public health czar for Quebec. You want to make Quebec the healthiest place on earth. So what would you do?
Health services that are available to kind of various social status.
Financial?
Yeah.
We're talking determinants of health. So that means, are rich people healthier than poor people? Yes, no. Okay. So finances, education. Are well-educated people healthier than poorly educated people?
Should be sure.
What else determines your health?
Nutrition.
The lifestyle. Okay, and what, you put a bunch of things there, right? Nutrition, what else? You need good food, you need clean food, water too,
hygiene
for sure. What other lifestyle issues?
Exercise.
Smoking said very quietly, I think.
Smoking is bad for your health?
A little bit,
okay. People still do it, though. I don't know why. So there you are.
What else?
Alcohol.
beyond
other things might affect your health.
Beyond lifestyle, what else?
Sometimes your gender.
So who's healthier? Yes.
So male sex is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. So you want you to have a healthier population, get rid of the old people. Okay.
Age usually isn't.
Access.
Okay. How important do you think access to healthcare is as a health determinant? Is it the main? If you had to pick a number one determinant of health. Would based on everything we've listed so far, would access be there?
Access to a doctor, would that be number one?
I put that quite high, but I'd say socioeconomic status is also.
If you look at industrialized countries, lifestyle factors are probably one of the main health determinants, mainly related to smoking, nutrition, physical activity, and healthy sexual practices. So although healthcare is important, it isn't the main determinant of health, especially in industrialized countries. What else can you think of as health determinants?
The prevalence of infectious diseases, epidemics, or
that's usually more covered as the health determinants will lead to certain infectious diseases or certain prevalence, so that you may, because if you don't have access to safe drinking water, you'll notice an increased prevalence of gastroenteric infections or certain infections, but it's not usually listed as social supports. Yes, so supportive social networks also determines people's general health status.
Yeah.
Maybe we have a list, a predetermined list that we could just flip to.
We do
somewhere in that pile of papers.
That looks scary.
This must be a lot of black. Yeah. So we covered quite a bit of those. We covered income, social status, social support networks, education, employment and working conditions. So that might be related to worker safety. Employment generally is protective or is a positive health determinant. In the case of maybe women who have several jobs, they're working full-time as mothers, and also in the workplace, that may not always be the case. Environmental factors, so that would include water quality issues, but also air pollution, other environmental exposures. We covered personal health practices. Child development, so healthy child development. It's actually a major determinant of health. Those early years are very important, and some public health programs target children specifically to make sure they're in supportive, healthy home environments in their initial months of development. We covered biology, genetics, gender, access to health services, and culture as well is something that influences health in a society. So particularly for a country like Canada, where you have a dominant cultural group and Aboriginal groups that haven't had control over their lands, resources, political structures, even healthcare institutions, that can have a major influence in terms of their health status as well.
So the Minister of Health should be working with the Minister of Finance, the Minister of Education, to make a healthier Quebec. So it's not, this doesn't mean necessarily more doctors. Not to pretend doctors. Doctors are good, right? Doctors are good. So doctors are still okay. But really, for a healthy society, you need people working on changes in lifestyle, working on getting people better educated, getting people a bit wealthier, will help the general health. It's something that a doctor won't be doing necessarily.
And it also points out, during this talk, we've been concentrating on mainly the clinical aspects of public health. And people often think of public health based on their experience with it, the forms and the reporting and the contact tracing. But you can see from these health determinants, in a lot of cases, public health may be involved in work that's not related at all to the clinical care environment, working with these health determinants, parks in cities and policy changes in government. So it's a much larger topic than just clinical care.
I have a question. I'm just curious about
we know from a while ago that trans fat is bad for us. But then after a while, we start to see, you know, on the market, chips that are trans fat free and all that. And it was public health like, involving this, you know, promoting, you know, trans fat free?
I may not be able to answer that question specifically, but for most policy changes, public health's role would be more to look at is something having a true effect on the population? So is smoking really bad for the population? So first of all, they'd establish, yes, there's a clear epidemiological list between smoking or obesity or trans fat and the health of our population. Then they'd also try and look at, well, what interventions have been tried or been successful elsewhere where there's been a positive effect on the population's health because of an intervention. And if it involves policy changes or clinical interventions, then they'll lobby or work to that end. So they wouldn't, public health isn't the group that writes the smoking law or bans trans fats. But they would look at the risk to the population and look at what's been successful. In some cases, a big element of public health interventions is to do an evaluation of the intervention. So if you do a public campaign for smoking, are you actually having the desired effect? So I remember going to one talk from a public health officer from the United Kingdom. And what he illustrated is they had this smoking cessation program, and the goal was to reduce smoking cessation rates. And they were very successful, but only in certain socioeconomic groups. So they actually decreased the smoking in higher socioeconomic groups, but there was an increased level of smoking in lower socioeconomic groups. So their intervention actually had some negative effects as well. So there is a need for an evidence-based approach in public health programs. Not just an assumption, well, this makes sense that people should be washing their hands, that it would prevent illness. You want to go in and see, well, did our intervention really, really have the desired effect on the population?
And how do you reach the population, of Quebec?
Depends
on the age. So you want to promote healthier sexual habits in the age group from 18 to 25, what would you do?
Programs within universities and whatnot, kind of like awareness campaign.
Mm-hmm. Free condoms in the cafeteria, this type of thing, is that what you're talking about? Or, yeah. I mean, how do you reach the 18-year-old group? I mean, that's a question that... Maybe. You know, I mean, I don't have an answer to this. This is something that public health would look at and see, right? Do you reach them through, you know, a certain radio station or a certain television station? Do you reach them in schools, in Facebook?
Twitter.
You know, Twitter.
Whatever Twitter
I mean, is
I
it, you know, what is, what? How do you reach, and what kind of a message will work and not work? You know, something can work to your disadvantage by, you know, making people suddenly aware that, hey, I could try anorexia as a lifestyle, you know. You know,
but it may
like
not
that.
Be just education as well. Yeah. So there's environmental aspects to even sexual health. So you might encourage healthy sexual behaviors, but it might be an issue of making sure condoms are available, that they don't have to go to the pharmacist and ask for the condom, that the condom is in the washroom next to the ad about syphilis or chlamydia or healthy sexuality. So you can really approach the problem from a variety of different angles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's true for anything, stopping smoking or whatever, you know, kind of know how, who you have to target, how you target them, and whether it's your action's going to make a difference or not. We didn't talk about housing particularly, but I guess that's...
No, I mean, that used to be one other example that when we were talking about health determinants. I work for public health for Northern Quebec, an Aboriginal group. Historically, they had very high levels of tuberculosis, and now they have very low levels of tuberculosis. And tuberculosis is an infectious disease. It's spread from person to person. Access to health care is one of the determinants of success in programs to control tuberculosis. But there's also the element of environment. So it's not because someone's necessarily aboriginal that they're at risk for an infection such as tuberculosis. It may have to do more with their environment. So they looked at housing density and First Nation communities, and they found a correlation between the housing density and the levels of tuberculosis in a community. So although they were respiratory specialists and other, I think, public health officials, they put together a review of this to encourage better housing conditions in First Nation communities as a way of addressing the problem of tuberculosis. So not just ensuring the case and contact follow-up for tuberculosis, but improving the overall health situation there through a health determinant.
So the bottom line is that we are all part of the public health network. All physicians and surgeons are part of the public health network. So whatever career path you take, you're still going to be part of the public health network of where you're working. So, you know, we have responsibilities not just to our patients, but to the society at large and to the public health network of our community. So you'll be called upon indefinitely to take part in some kind of public health work as part of whatever it is you're doing, whether it's reporting, whether it's treating or whatever. We're all going to be part of the public health network. It's I think one of the good things about our system, and something that I think it's important for you all to sort of be, when you are working, to figure out where you fit in that public health network and how you're going to liaise with it and how you're going to be part of it.
Sometimes we have a computer, which
yes.
we don't have today.
Not this time, no.
But we'll still give you a list of some online resources. So these are free, good for student budgets. But we're just providing you a few web links, and I'll just take one quick minute to go over some of the content that's available. There's a website for the Montreal Public Health Department. There's a section reserved for health professionals. Some of the appels à la vigilance or alerts that Dr. Dalton was mentioning are often posted on the Montreal Public Health website. So if you want to know if there's measles circulating or something that's been detected, it's posted there. There's also information on other public health programs that are being implemented or available on the island of Montreal at that website. There's the Public Health Agency of Canada site, which is the federal public health site. There's a pretty long list of information that's available at that site. I highlighted one particular clinical guide that's particularly well done is the Canadian Guidelines on Sexually Transmitted Infections. It's updated regularly, so if you want to know how do I treat chlamydia, how do I test for it, what do I do with a woman who has pelvic inflammatory disease, what if a guy has urethritis, they cover it by specific infection, by syndrome. It's a very, very complete reference. They even have slides available and some self-learning modules if you want to go to that particular site. Similarly, the province, through the Ministry of Health and Social Services, they also have some information available online. There, some of the subjects that I mentioned at the Public Health Agency of Canada site are there, but what's particularly well done for the provincial site is the immunization protocol. So it's the Protocol d'immunisation du Québec. It's only available in French, but it's a very complete reference for all of the vaccines that are delivered in the public health programs in Quebec. It gives a complete detailing of what is in the vaccine, where it's indicated, what are the common and rare side effects, what are the effects of the disease that you're preventing, patient information. Mm-hmm. There's some even basic immunology information that's in one of the chapters. So if you're looking for vaccine information, it's a very good reference.
It's very good. There's a chapter on how to give vaccines. It talks about different needles, different syringes, different approaches for different kinds of vaccines. I know you have a vaccine workshop, but you know it's always good to look at the PIC. It's called the Protocol d'immunisation du Québec, and it's just everything you'd ever want to know about vaccines is there. It's really, really well done. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And the last site we wanted to highlight, although it's not in Canada, is the CDC site, which is the Centers for Disease Control in the States. Although the epidemiology is very similar between Canada and the U.S., there may be situations where they've implemented vaccination programs at different times where you might notice that the recommendations are a little bit different in Canada as opposed to the United States. But there's a lot of really good information on public health topics on the CDC site. There's one in particular, their travel section, where it gives a complete and updated listing for each country, what vaccines are recommended in terms of basic immunization and additional vaccines, malaria prophylaxis, general prevention, if there's any outbreaks going on in the country. So although it's recommended for most people to consult a travel clinic, for some destinations you can get quite a bit of information just off the CDC website, and it's regularly updated as well.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
That's it. That's all. Thank you very much for your attention. Now, I know you've done your rural month already, right? Most of you haven't done your rural month yet. So when you're doing next month, if you're doing your rural month, one of the things you might want to do is to ask your supervisors what their connection is with the public health of the area. Find out how the public health network works wherever it is you are. And you get sort of a feeling for how the doctors in that community interact with public health. Okay, good. Have a good afternoon.